Coming up on Boston Public Radio, politicians steal, lie, take bribes, and tweet out pictures of themselves in their underpants. Yet right here in Boston, a Democrat who wants to be governor can't run because of an ethical dilemma that, to many, seems like no dilemma at all. Jared Bowen joins us to review new movies and theaters in town. Then a new poll says 40% of white Americans have not a single solitary non-white friend. Do you?
I do. And if it's Thursday, it must be open mic with Christopher Lydon. He says the fact that the Boston Globe and the Washington Post were both bought by non-newspaper guys is a point to celebrate. Then Kara Miller on Kickstarter.com, the fundraising website that helps entrepreneurs fulfill their dreams. Even filmmaker Spike Lee is in on the deal. That's all coming up on Boston Public Radio.
And she is Emily Rooney from Greater Boston, filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. This is Boston Public Radio. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Marjorie. It's almost Friday.
I know. Thank you for filling in for Jim.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Very much fun. So you had State Senator Dan Wolf on your television show last night. Dan Wolf, if people don't know, he's a liberal Democrat. He's running for governor. He's also a founder and part owner of Cape Air, which flies in and out of Logan Airport and has to pay, like everybody else, you know, all the other airlines, certain fees and rents to Massport. The State Ethics Commission just ruled that this is a conflict of interest, and Wolf either has to give up ownership in his airline or abandon not only his run for a state for governor, but give up his state Senate seat as well. Let's listen to Dan Winslow on Emily's show last night talking about the two rather undesirable choices he now faces because of this commission ruling.
One is to dismantle the airline that I spent 27 years building, and the other is to not represent the folks of the Cape and Islands who have overwhelmingly elected me for two elections in a row. So it's not a great choice.
It's bad because, you know, I asked him, well, couldn't you put the airline into a blind trust? And he says, no, because you have to not know what's in a blind trust in order, and he would know exactly what was in it. So he has to divest, which means sell the thing, or, you know, not run for governor.
You know, I find this rather bizarre. And by the way, if you guys would like to weigh in on this, our number is 877-301-8970. I would say that we are a somewhat ethically challenged state. We've had three speakers in a row indicted, Sal DeMasi now doing 8 years, before that Thomas Finneran, before that Charlie Flaherty. Three speakers in a row, like a trifecta. We have the former state senator, Diane Wilkerson, still in jail for taking bribes. The former city councilor, Chuck Turner, just got out of jail for taking a very small bribe.
Right. The former state treasurer was on trial.
Yes, the state treasurer was on trial. And here you have a guy that's running for governor. People should understand, everybody at Logan, as you pointed out on Greater Boston last night, pays the same fees to fly in and out of there. There's no bidding. There's no bid.
The problem is you have to sign a contract.
Yes.
And so he signs a contract. And by the way, he told me that the federal government sets the fee rate. There's no negotiating. So it's not like there's no potential of favoritism is the point.
Well, that's what I don't understand about this. The State Ethics Commission, which hasn't been so quick ruling on these other nefarious characters that have been running around here, says that state employees are prohibited from having financial interests in state contracts. Well, Emily, as you point out, he does have a contract. But there's no issue of getting a sweetheart deal, is there?
Yeah. What is the financial interest in a state contract? It suggests that you have something to gain. And by the way, as he pointed out, he pays them. It's not like they're paying him to fly the airplanes in there. He pays them.
And the thing is, too, about this is that it's sort of a chilling thing for a person in business. You know, we've had a lot of Republican governors that have been businessmen. Of course, Mitt Romney being the most recent one. Bill Well was mostly in government service, and Paul Cellucci was too. But this is a Democrat who's built up a business. I guess Christy Myhouse, he didn't do well when he ran for governor, but he ran Christie's markets down the Cape for all those years. Here you have a Democrat who's a businessman who's founded a great company. He can't run because he has to sign a contract.
And they're telling me he has to give up his Senate seat. The interesting thing is, though, he went to the Ethics Commission, so he knew there was a question here. So what's the problem here? Why can't he live with the answer? That's the bigger issue, because if he went to them asking if this was – if he could proceed with his run for governor, he had to be prepared for the answer to be no. I did ask him about that, too. And there is no formal appeal process.
No.
He can go back to them, but he's got a deadline on this.
Well, that was the thrust of Joan Vernacki's column in the Boston Globe, where she basically said, you know, the Ethics Commission has ruled. He talks about not wanting to fight the Ethics Commission, and it's not a good way to start out your race for a governor in Massachusetts with all our other ethical challenges, challenging the Ethics Commission right out of the box. So it doesn't look good. You know, Bob Hedlund, who's a Republican, who's certainly not in going to vote for Dan Wolf, even if he does get a chance to be in the election, has said that the legislature should go in and make change this legislatively. But then you have a guy that's running for office getting an ethics rule change. So it's tricky. 877-301-8970 is the number. I just find this sort of an overkill, overreach.
It is. The other thing is he's impressive.
He's impressive.
I don't know Dan Wolf. I've had him on a couple times about a couple other issues, but he is. He's a solid citizen, a solid candidate. He'd make a good run for governor. There's a bunch of people on the Democratic side, and this is somebody you want to have, you know, in the mix. Somebody who would be a viable choice, and to take him out on this seems, yeah, overkill.
So I guess the question to you guys is: do you think this is an overreach too? Is this a situation of overkill? Should Dan Wolf have to divest himself of the company he founded to become the governor, or to keep his Senate seat? And they're fairly happy with him down in on the Cape. He's won re-election twice. 877-301-8970. Dave, in the car, you are first on the Dan Wolf dilemma discussion. What do you think, Dave?
Well, my first question would be: is how is this any different than a state legislator who writes drunk driving laws being a drunk driving attorney? How is that any different? And if it is different, explain to me how it is. So I don't get it. If the legislators are allowed to, you know, write the laws in which they practice law, for example, or real estate or insurance, how is that different than what they're saying this guy's going to do?
You know, Dave, that is a brilliant point.
Excellent.
A brilliant point. To me, the lawyers that are practicing as defense attorneys and then refusing to write tough drunk driving laws. Remember the great story, Dave? Ron Bersani, whose granddaughter Melanie was run over by a drunk driver in the middle of the afternoon. And Ron Bersani is one of the class great acts of all time. I've had the opportunity to interview him many times. He's trying to get the laws changed so these repeat drunk drivers can't get back out on the road again. And they're trying to pass this legislation on Beacon Hill. And he's single-handedly lobbying every one of these legislators. And then the legislators take off for some trip. Where'd they go? Portugal? I think it was Portugal. And their pictures are in the paper, drinking their Brandy Alexanders in Portugal while they don't pass this legislation. Because you're right, Dave, a conflict of interest. Is he not right?
Yeah. This has been going on for years, and because we're a one-party state, nothing really happens. You know, there's some hand-wringing. You know, the Globe will have an editorial. But it really, you know, the drunk driving laws, everyone knows if you get caught drunk driving in this state, if you go to a certain attorney and you have enough money, chances are you're getting it off. And the reason why is they've crafted the law so there's escape clauses. So, you know, I don't see how this is any different. So same thing with insurance regulations, because I know there's insurance agents who are also state legislators. So I can't understand why the Ethics Committee would do this. The second question I would have is, who's on the Ethics Committee? And is this in any way politically motivated to keep this guy down from, you know, because he says he's an impressive guy, has an impressive resume. Maybe they don't want to give him a chance.
Dave, thank you for the call. That is a great question, too. And frankly, I don't know. There was a little bit of scuttlebutt that a Wired Democratic operative tweeted out about Dan Wolf's ethics problems before it was widely known. But I don't know if that particular operative is supporting any particular candidate. I don't know if there's any shenanigans involving this. And I don't know if there's any political motivations in the state's Ethics Commission. But I do know that Dan Wolf is an impressive guy. He's built a business. He was terrific on your show last night. I've seen him in other interviews. He's a very credible candidate. Our number is 877-301-8970. Does a guy who's built up a business, who does have state contracts, absolutely, but they're the same as everybody else's. There's no issue of a sneaky, a no-bid deal
favoritism
here or favoritism. Is this the sort of person you want to prohibit from running for office or having to give up his office? You know what's something else that drives me nuts about talking about defense attorneys in the state legislature? tough sexual assault, the whole three strikes and you're out thing, which many people disagree with. But that means that if you've been convicted for more than a couple of violent offenses,
felonies,
you're going to be doing some serious time in jail. It's very difficult to get that through the legislature because so many legislators are defense lawyers. But the biggest sin of all to me was elderly driving legislation. In Massachusetts, unlike almost every other state in the nation, you take your driver's test at 16. You never take another one until
ever.
You're 110. If you last that long, you'll be dead. You never have to take another one. Now, why do you think we have not been able
to get...
A lot
of other states have that, too.
Well,
When my father died, his license was viable until 2018.
What state? New York?
New York.
A lot of states are bad, but many other states are much better than we are. And we tried in Massachusetts to get reasonable checks on elderly people who have lost their sight or they suffer from dementia or whatever. Couldn't get it through. You know why? Because the AARP is enormously powerful at the legislature. And the legislators were afraid of the elderly
vote. They definitely have something to gain. See, the problem here is that this is sort of the letter of the law because it says specifically state contracts. And with all these other things that have just been mentioned, it's not in. It doesn't say stands to benefit by because of – it's a literal contract with the state
Well, I guess the bottom line here is does this make Dan Wolf ethically challenged? I would say no. I mean, is this a conflict of interest like having a legislature full of defense attorneys who are representing drunk driving clients or elderly people who run people down? 877-301-8970. I would say no. David, in a traffic jam at the Bourne Bridge, what do you think?
I think we've reached the point where we're penalizing competence in our elected officials. Dan Wolf gets elected here because he is a very competent businessman running a very competent airline, and the reason he doesn't own all of it is because he gave a big chunk of it away to his employees.
Wow.
That's great.
He only owns 20% of it. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, but the rest of it is owned by his employees, and he gave it to them. Just absolutely out and out gave it to them.
Really?
This man, he's exactly what you want in every state legislator. It's what you want in every governor.
There's a very strong supporter. David, before you hang up, how bad is the traffic at the Bourne Bridge?
Yeah, Marjorie wants to know.
Well, right now I'm at exit 3, and it started about 6 miles out. It's bad.
Oh, really? It's
gosh.
Only Thursday.
That's why I want Dan Wolf in the governorship. Maybe he can do something about this.
He'll give everybody an airplane.
Yeah, that's a brilliant idea.
Romney attacked the Sagamore Bridge. Maybe he'll attack the Bourne Bridge.
We can fly over the canal. David, that's a great idea. Dan Wolf Airlines to get you over the canal. 877-301-8970. You know, speaking of drunk driving legislation, Brian Joyce, a state senator, has been a fearless crusader to get reasonable drunk driving legislation. And he keeps track of, you know, every time there's someone driving, thinking the drive-through at the CVS means literally drive through the CVS. The best story he ever told was about a guy who had his license. He called the police. He was in the Lower Cape somewhere, I don't know, Orleans or Brewster or something. He calls the police and he says, I'm stuck in a snowdrift. It's a blizzard and I can't get out. And the cops are looking at each other saying, it's August. What is this guy talking about? They get down to rescue the guy. He's in a sand trap on a golf course and he thinks he's stuck in a snowdrift. And this man was driving his car. 877-301-8970. Craig in the road, what do you think about Dan Wolf, whether or not he's ethically challenged because he has a contract, like every other airline operator, to land his airplanes at Logan Airport? Craig?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm on 128, and I can't really hear all that well. But I don't understand why you don't put two and two together. Here's a very powerful businessman in Massachusetts. And you're concerned about whether he's going to pat his own pocket. How many cronies does he have? How many business associates whose pockets he could easily pat? So I see a very distinct conflict of interest. And
explain that again.
I can't hear better, so I'm just going to have to make my point hang up.
Okay.
What is he talking about?
I think his point was that he's a wealthy businessman and therefore he's going to be able to line a lot of pockets.
Well,
I mean,
you could have said that about Deval Patrick or Mitt Romney
or Bill Wells.
Yeah, you got to give people the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. I don't think everybody's
people resent rich people. Have you ever noticed that?
That's because we're all jealous.
I know.
Emily, they resent them.
We want to have
assume they're crooked or something. All that money. So let's take one more call. Jim in the car. What do you think, Jim?
Hi, this is Jim. I'm in Weston at this point.
Mm-hmm. How's the traffic in Weston?
pretty light.
Good.
Pretty light, thank goodness. My point really is I'm concerned that this show is being broadcast at all. This question shouldn't even be raised. My point is that normal people can't run for office because the news media will find something that they did 10, 15, 20 years ago, 5 years ago, and make an issue out of it, because that is the nature of journalism. Because conflict is the nature of journalism. It's what drives it.
Okay, but this has nothing to do with journalism.
Jim, we didn't bring this up. This is the Ethics Commission. I think we're both defending the guy who wants to run for office.
You're bringing it up on the air right now.
Right, because it's going to knock him out of the race.
Sorry. The point I'm trying to make is that I think you should ignore that particular slander and don't publicize it. Because once you publicize it, even if people take
slander
side, sure.
This is a ruling by the State Ethics Commission. How is that slander?
Being that, okay, now here we go. Suddenly he's got a state ethics problem.
Well, that's the whole crux of the story, Jim. The reason we're talking about this, and maybe you misunderstood it, thank you for the call, is that a guy
that's
running for governor, very legitimate guy, has a good platform, is being told he can't because of the State Ethics Commission.
However, he's not wrong about how the media goes after the slightest little things.
Well, we do. I mean,
I couldn't run for office.
No,
they come and get me.
I couldn't run for office, and I think that I credit people who do, who are willing to run
and
for office.
And Dan Wolf is one. Who's
and
an
I am ready to
honorable
examine
citizen.
To the ends of the earth any new twist in the Anthony Weiner
exactly
story.
Exactly,
as well. So I guess Jim is half right, but not in this particular case.
No.
This is not a media-created story. This is an Ethics Commission-created story. Okay, Emily, where are we going now?
All right, we are done with that. I'm looking for my script, which I don't seem to have. Here it is. Yes, well... No one likes to see the summer come to an end, but the silver lining is that fall is a great season for theatergoers, movie buffs. Jared Bowen is going to preview what's coming up in some hot movies and theater around town. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Philip Martin. I live here, and I report here.
Without ever knowing it, you've driven the same routes, passed the same landmarks, and used the same rest stops as today's human trafficking networks.
I think I'm always in reporter mode.
Who's orchestrating this trafficking network from New York to New England?
And it's so important to be aware of the things that are going on in our life and to incorporate that into journalism.
Philip Martin, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you. And Subaru of New England, introducing the all-new redesigned Subaru Forester with all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com.
And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Before the summer art season ends, Jared Bowen says there are some shows and movies that are worth taking in, and Jared joins us now in Studio 3. He's WGBH's arts reporter and the host of Open Studio. Hi,
hey, Jared.
Hi, ladies.
Good to have you, as always.
You're so calm after that last call. I expected to come in and find flames in here.
It's okay. I'm used to it.
How do we handle it?
Yeah.
You handled it well.
So... tell us about this Spectacular Now. Actually, we have a little sound from the Spectacular Now to get us in the mood. Can we hear a little clip from this movie, and then Jared's going to tell us all about it.
What's your story?
I don't really have any stories.
What do you mean? Everyone's got a story.
I don't know. I'd like to think that there's more to a person than just one thing.
You know, I gotta tell you, Sutter, Amy Finicky, this is a strange choice for a rebound.
You're 17 years old. You don't have an ex-boyfriend?
No.
Really?
Sutter, guys don't
look
at me
shocking.
Like that. That's shocking.
Yeah, absolutely, guys look at you like
no,
that.
No, no,
Amy, you're absolutely beautiful.
Oh, my God, no.
And if she falls for you, what happens then?
Jared, you were really taken by this one.
This is
what's the name of it again?
It's really interesting. It's called The Spectacular Now, and it's based on a novel of the same name. And
young
it's
love.
It's young love. It's coming of age, but yes. It's told from the other side of the tracks. So you don't have sort of you think teenage coming of age story. You think Risky Business and John Cusack, or at least I do, because those are the movies I grew up watching. But those were also always in those nice big suburban McMansion homes, and they had all these resources and the wealthy parents who sweep in at the end to save them. That does not happen in this movie. So you have this, it basically starts with the guy here, Sutter Keeley, played by Miles Teller, lying out on the grass, and this girl, Shailene Woodley, who people might remember as a daughter in The Descendants, and she's finding him drunk on this lawn, and they just find each other, and they find this relationship in difficult circumstances. She doesn't have the greatest home life. She's doing her mother's paper route. That's her mother's job.
Oh.
And he's just trying to get out of the house because it's not a comfortable situation. And these two find each other and try to make their way, and it's very sweet.
Is it a tragic ending?
It's also very difficult. Emily, you know, I never. Marjorie, she asked me the ending to every single show,
Emily,
movie.
Did you know that?
Not
of course
supposed
I do.
To do that.
I never give away the ending, except for once. I told you the ending to War Horse.
Yeah.
Just because I felt bad. I wanted you to see the show.
Yeah. I couldn't. War Horse was going to be too much for me. Yeah. Animal violence is always too distressing for me. But this sounds great. I love young passion movies. Don't you, Emily?
Yeah, very sweet.
Okay.
But I have to say that Shailene Woodley is fantastic in this movie, and this is about the time where we can start to prognosticate about the Oscars a little bit, and there's a lot of buzz about her as best actress, and it may happen. I'm not sure she would win, but she gives a really compelling performance. You can't take your eyes off of her.
Now, this Meet the Millers, I've seen this all over television.
There's no way I'm going to go see this.
Yeah, this doesn't look like a great one, but go ahead. Explain what Meet the Millers is, please.
See, I think if Jim was here, he would side with me because I think he likes his guilty pleasures, and this is a guilty pleasure movie. This is... I can't even say it with a straight face. This is Jennifer Aniston and Jason Sudeikis, who rent an RV basically so they can drive to Mexico and smuggle drugs back over the border. But they have to craft this illusion of a family. Mm-hmm. So speaking of people who are from unfortunate situations, Jennifer Aniston is a stripper. Jason Sudeikis plays this guy who's already been brought up on drug charges. And then they get this girl who's homeless and this very unfortunate boy who's just lost in life. And they have to come together as a family. And in the end, they do. And it's actually kind of a sweet movie. However, Jennifer Aniston should not be playing a stripper here. She should have watched Demi Moore in Striptease because it just doesn't work.
It doesn't?
I should have had something different for her. But otherwise,
she doesn't do a good striptease?
She doesn't.
She doesn't?
No. Not that I'm a connoisseur, but
yeah.
I think I know a little bit.
So it's not like Alec Baldwin's ex-wife in that 9 1/2 weeks. Remember that?
Oh, Kim Basinger.
Yeah, Kim Basinger. Yeah. That was impressive.
She's hot.
I thought you were talking about his new yoga instructor wife.
No.
But I wouldn't know that.
No,
either.
We haven't.
He's getting his own show too, right?
He is.
On MSNBC.
And he has a show on NPR that I listen to every now and again. I just happen to. He's a great interviewer.
Yeah. Alec Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin is.
Well,
yeah.
He's also
I ran into
lost
him on the
weight
in New York once.
You did? He's married the yoga instructor now, and I think he's lost about 30 pounds.
He has.
I saw him in Blue Jasmine. He was looking more fit.
He does look great. He's the most generous person. I have this little story. I was the summer I was working in New York for NBC at one point. I saw the free theater in the park, and at intermission I went to get something, water or something, at the concession stand, and Alec Baldwin was in line in front of me, and everybody who was in line at that moment, he bought all their stuff.
Really?
Such a nice guy. Yeah.
Nice guy.
When he's not screaming at his daughter all the time.
That was the worst. When he called his 12-year-old a pig.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Probably right. All right.
But I just want to get the up or down. Meet the Millers is a fun, guilty pleasure, but not a great movie.
It's not a must-see. It's probably better for DVD, but I thought it was kind of funny.
Okay.
And it's sweet. But and that's what I think is funny about this, is that this has to be your classic American family story now, is, you know, drug dealer father, stripper mother, so on and so forth.
All right. I think you're going to have a hard to sell with this Elysium movie.
Well, I'm not going to sell it because it's not a very good movie, unfortunately. Now, Elysium, it has this great concept where basically it's the year 2154. The Earth is overpopulated. And so society has crafted sort of this satellite place in space that looks like Weston or Wellesley. It's very, you know, green lawns, nice homes. Jodie Foster is the Secretary of Defense up there. And this is where anybody who's wealthy can go, and there's free medical treatment, and basically any ailment can be cured. So Matt Damon plays this person on Earth, and he just wants to be saved. He was radiated at his job, and so he just wants to get up to the space station. It could have been a great story about the haves and the have-nots. It was crafted by the same guy who wrote and produced the film District 9, which is another great look at, you know, the immigrant situation through these allegories of the future. But it just doesn't work. The movie falls apart, unfortunately. And I have to say, as much as I love Jodie Foster, it's one of the worst performances I've ever seen her give. So unfortunately, it just doesn't work at the end. Because I think they focus too much time on what's happening on Earth, which isn't all that interesting. And you really want to know more about this dichotomy and the contrast of these two different societies.
Is he making a Whitey Bulger movie?
He's supposed to be, yeah.
Is that Damon?
With Ben Affleck, because there was a competing film with Johnny Depp, and that one went away. Johnny Depp dropped out for some reason. But apparently the Matt Damon one is still going forward.
And Matt Damon would be Whitey?
I believe so, yeah.
And Ben would be the director?
I think so, yeah, and I think that they're writing it together.
Maybe he plays Stephen Fleming.
I don't think so. That's not right.
Actually, Matt Damon.
James Gandolfini, whatever, he would have been good for that, but he's gone now.
As Whitey?
No, Fleming.
Oh, or Moderano. He would have been a really good
Moderano. Because he's kind of beefy, or he was kind of beefy.
He's gone now.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, we're going to move on to theater. I ran into you last night, so I know you saw Hip Hop Dreams.
Yes, I walked in just at the last second because I was having too much fun with you before the theater. But I saw How We Got On, which is presented by Company One, and it's playing only through this Saturday, August 17th at the BCA. This is a really great piece. It's basically about the birth of rap and hip hop, and it's told from sort of these two regular guys in a no-name Midwestern town, and basically they discover that this is their language, this is their art, this is their vocabulary. They're both teenagers, and this is how they can express themselves is through hip hop and rap, and it's so innocent. And it really is sort of, you know, they're coming into their own. Rap is coming into its own. It's set in 1988, the same time as Yo MTV Raps has just launched. And it's sort of presided over by this narrator who almost presents the show and introduces you to the show in the form of a mixtape or a rap. And it's really, really interesting. And, of course, it all culminates with the two guys. And later a young woman joins them, too, who is really fantastic. And they have a sort of a hip-hop off showcase, and that's what really folds the audience in. Hmm. And so the audience, you're sitting there and you want to be a part of this. You're screaming, you're clapping. Well, not screaming, but you're clapping with them and really engaged in this piece. So it's a great form of theater. It's a great story. It's very well directed, very well acted.
And it's only 80 minutes.
And it's 90 minutes. Yeah, I was slightly misled.
Oh. That's a good length.
Oh, I know. These things go on for an hour and a half.
By the way, if you're in your car furiously worrying about writing these things down, we're going to post all the names of these movies and plays on our website at wgbhnews.org so you can check it out if you don't want to worry. I always have that problem when we do the music segment. I'm trying to furiously write, but then I realize, why am I writing this down? I can read them later. They're on the website.
Yeah. What I should mention, because I'm sure people are listening, and I probably had the same bias when I first heard about this piece, is the association you bring to rap and hip-hop now. Which is everything. It's misogynistic, and it's a lot about crime and drugs, and that is not how hip hop and rap began. It really did harken back in some way to poetry, and it was a different form of expression. So that's why I also love this piece, because it has this sort of nostalgia and this appreciation for the very pure way in which this form began.
All right. So this is one I actually really do want to see, but it's going to be gone, I think, by the time I'm going to be able to see it, because I'm going on vacation. But is it Cavalia?
It's Cavalia and Odiseo.
Odiseo.
So Cavalia is essentially, to just be blunt, it's Cirque du Soleil with horses.
Yeah.
And this is a really beautiful show because they have about 60 horses in the show, and they have a lot of the big theatrical elements that you would expect from Cirque du Soleil, because it is one of their co-founders who branched off and founded Cavalia. And it basically just sort of trots you. I didn't even intend that. It trots you around the globe, and you just get this appreciation for the horse. I mean, one of the most mesmerizing pieces to me was this woman standing in the middle of the stage, and it's this very large, big top tent in Assembly Square in Somerville.
Yeah, I wondered about that.
Yeah.
How big is it with all these horses?
It's huge. And then you see it from the highway, it's enormous. And then you get on site, and it's even bigger because they, like Cirque du Soleil as well, they keep everything there.
Like half a football field big, or how big?
I would say so, yeah. It's really enormous.
And how many people can sit around this?
Quite a few. And I like like the way they have it here. It's not in the round like Cirque du Soleil usually is, but it's a regular, more traditional proscenium seating.
Okay.
But this woman is standing in the middle of the ring, and just with the slightest gesture of her hand, she's making these horses move around her and then turning and going back in the other direction. Wow. And you can see she's, you know, essentially somewhat of a horse whisperer, because she has these horses just drawn to her every movement, and that's how she manipulates them without whips or anything like that. And then, you have these great stunts, people galloping across the stage, and at one point there's one rider who actually circles himself around the horse, going underneath and back up onto the saddle. I don't know how he did it. It's crazy.
So the posters on all the buses have the white horse with the really, really long mane. Yeah, is there one?
No, I think that's sort of just an illustration of all the horses. But they have a lot of Arabians, which are that color and just gorgeous, exquisite creatures. But I have to say, in some regard, the humans actually steal the show here, because I think the costumes and the sets aren't as extravagant as Cirque du Soleil. And I think that's good, because it allows you to focus more on what they're actually doing without being so distracted by the theatrical elements. And what they're doing is phenomenal. I mean, just I thought I had seen every level of acrobatics at this point, and I hadn't until I was seeing Cavalia.
You know, just one thing. So you wonder where these people that perform in this come from. Are they people – obviously, they're people that are great riders, equestrians, but they'd also have to be great acrobatics. So do you go out and recruit – you know, do you get people that can be great acrobatics?
They go all over the world.
They do.
I don't know the number of countries, but it may even be in the 20s. I mean, they really have a very, very tight operation in terms of how they cast their net and the training. And I've done some stories behind the scenes at shows like this, and it's incredible. They practice religiously. They have on-site therapists and physical therapy
people. For the horses?
For the horses, for the people. I mean, this is a whole tight operation. Yeah, the horses deserve it. I'm sure they probably are treated even better than
that's
the humans.
Yeah, that's grueling for the horses. How many shows do they have to do?
I mean, I think it's just one, and I don't think – I just came back from my riding vacation in Montana, and I don't think it's as bad for them as you might think.
Mm.
And
imagine a traveling
exercise.
Therapist.
Yeah. I could use one of those now.
Yeah, just in case you have a bad day.
Went on vacation with me.
Exactly.
I thought you had one, Emily. Isn't that in your contract here at GBH?
Yeah, I need one.
It's Jared Bowen. All right, and finally, Wicked, which has been around a while. I've never seen this.
Really?
No.
You know about witches,
Emily. Oh, I do.
Emily?
I do.
Nice. Really? What do you know?
I am one.
Oh! I didn't know that, Emily. Watch out.
If I had known that you've never seen it, I would have made you come with me.
Oh.
This is one of my absolute favorite shows. I just love the music. And for people who don't know, it's the backstory of the Wicked Witch of the West and basically what made her become wicked. And it's based on a novel written by Gregory Maguire, who's a local author. And when he was a child, he was semi-obsessed with the film The Wizard of Oz, and he began wondering why she was wicked, because you never really learn. You're just told she is. And this
True.
Is something he also looked at through the prism of Saddam Hussein during the first Gulf War. He found himself in England, and suddenly there was this ravenous attention paid to Saddam Hussein. We were told, here's this horrible leader in the Middle East. Of course, that did bear out, but it made him think how we as a society accept these labels. So that's why he went back and told the backstory of the Wicked Witch of the West, where she has a friendship with Glinda, you know, the witch in the bubble.
Oh, yes, I all remember her. I think I've watched The Wizard of Oz about 150 times over the years.
But this is such the music is fantastic, and this production, I've got to tell you, is terrific. It's been on tour for a little while, and sometimes the wheels start to run off the wagon. That does not happen here. It's still beautiful. The costumes are great. The talent is great. John Davidson plays, you probably remember him from game shows other things that he's done, Disney movies. He plays the wizard here. It's a great production. It's a good one to see.
And this is the one you can take your kids.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a really great message for girls about empowerment and being strong and being yourself and resisting what labels society wants to put on you. Absolutely bring your family.
Is that here now?
It's here now. It's playing through September 15th at the Boston Opera House.
Is there anything coming up this fall that you're...
What about The Butler? Have you seen that yet?
I haven't seen The Butler, no.
Oh, yeah, with Oprah Winfrey playing...
It comes out tomorrow.
Mrs. Butler.
Yeah.
Yeah, it begins tomorrow on the course.
I think it's going to be problematic, don't you? I mean, it's hard to watch Oprah on screen and think, oh, she's the wife, without thinking, oh, the butler's married to Oprah.
Yeah.
It's hard. I don't think she really dissolves into a character very much.
I don't know.
But I haven't seen it yet.
I don't know. Callie said it was fantastic.
All right.
And that Oprah was really good.
Well, I should just mention very quickly, Artists for Humanity, a group which I love and talk about frequently because they put kids to work in the summer making art, and it's a real job, and they have to sell their art. That's how they make their money. Well, they do get paid for working, but then they make half the money from their art. They are having a big sale next Thursday, August 22nd, at their Artists for Humanity Center, which they were just in the news recently because Gillette has turned over the piece of property behind them in South Boston, so they're going to be able to expand. I mean, they are doing such great things for kids in the city, especially during summertime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've profiled them before.
So you can go buy their art. But two big shows that you should pay attention to are Bryan Cranston starring as LBJ in All the Way at the ART coming up in September, which should be very interesting. Rumor has it it's on its way to Broadway, as I think so many ART shows are these days. And so this is his first major project after Breaking Bad concludes its season. And then over at the Huntington, you have The Jungle Book, which also probably will end up in Broadway. And this is the first theatrical adaptation done by Mary Zimmerman. She's a MacArthur Genius Grant winner. And she traveled to India, really absorbed the culture, the costume, the look. And so I think you won't see a Disney-fied version here. Certainly some of the Disney songs and sentiment from the film, but also taking in Kipling's stories to craft this piece.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, I say this all the time because I cover the arts, but I think it's such an exciting time to be in Boston. The fact that Bryan Cranston is coming here, his first project after Breaking Bad, we are such a magnet now, I think, for great artists and exhibitions and theater and film that comes here. It's a great time.
It's great. Wonderful. Sounds great.
Sounds great.
All right.
I'm going.
That's it.
Okay. What's up next?
All right. Coming up, we do our best not to single out any one group here at WGBH. If you think of yourself as a white person, though, how many friends do you have who are non-white? A new poll says 40% of whites have people of color as their friends. That discussion is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In 10 years from now, we're going to see tens of millions of buildings all over the world producing their own green power. And in 20 years, we're going to see several hundred million existing and new buildings on Earth producing their own green electricity.
And he's been right before. I'm Kara Miller. An in-depth look at green energy and our economy with forward-thinking energy expert Jeremy Rifkin on Innovation Hub tonight at 9 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Westin Copley Place. You can relax in their newly renovated guest rooms or dine on fresh local seafood at Turner Fisheries Restaurant. More information at turnersboston.com and westincopleyplaceboston.com/SIC. And Grogan & Company, fine art auctioneers, assisting New England families with the sale of their fine art, antiques, silver, and jewelry since 1988. Located in historic Dedham, Massachusetts, and at groganco.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Marjorie Egan. Emily Rooney is filling in for Jim Browdy. Now, Emily, you're a white person. I'm a white person. Callie Crossley is here with us. She's an African-American person. So this is the perfect troika to discuss this. A new Reuters poll says 40% of all white Americans do not have one single solitary non-white friend, which brings up all kinds of questions. What does it mean to have a friend? What does it say about race and class and geography? What are the implications if 40% of whites don't have a trusting relationship with someone who doesn't look like them? I think this is a great time to talk about this because we had a big discussion after the Trayvon Martin verdict where Black America saw that verdict one way, white America saw it a different way. You heard white people say over and over again, well, I talked to my Black friends and they said such and such and such and such a thing. Does this mean that 60% of them were lying because they didn't really have any Black friends to say things to? And my definition of a friend, by the way, is not like, I mean, Callie's a friend of mine, but you're a work friend of mine. You know, we have socialized somewhat, but, you know, I have not told you my intimate secrets, Callie. You've not told me yours. Maybe we'll do that in the future. But I mean, I think to me, a white cross-racial friend is not a work friend, but maybe some people would disagree with that. Anyway, our number is 877-301-8970 if you'd like to weigh in on how diverse your friends are and if this matters. And by the way, 25% of non-white people said they are mostly with people of their own race too. So, Callie, what do you think about this?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head in one way, because I have a very, very narrow definition of friend. And it does really mean a deep relationship and someone who has exchanged a lot. So I do not mean a water cooler buddy where people are talking, chatting at the water cooler and they're referring to their black friend whom they exchange three words with every day at the water cooler. Okay. I'm also not talking about their black acquaintance who they may have five or ten words with during the week in the work situation or in other situations. I'm talking about somebody with whom you share an intimate exchange where you know them and they really know you. You have socialized together. You know intimate secrets, as you've said. You've crossed the burning sands, because when you have
cross-racial
relationships, you must cross the burning sands of some ugly conversation before you get to the other side. That's just the way it is. Because there, the way that the social construct of race is set up in America specifically, there are so many inherent biases that you really have to work through them. And a lot of times, that's just some rough conversation you're going to have. But so that's what I mean about crossing the burning sands.
Yep.
If you've not had that conversation, if you don't know the intimate secrets, if you've not socialized, and I mean socialized, you do not have a friend. So even these 40% people are lying. please, my whole life I've seen this. 40%.
Well, except that one of the things that the survey did point out is this is very regional and geographic specific. They said that the Pacific states, California in particular, you are more likely to have a non-white friend. I mean, California is so diverse.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
And Asian, so it goes beyond that. Yeah. And then the South, it was the least likely. That's really no surprise. And also it pointed out that younger people were more likely to have friends that more diverse, because it's just completely different, you know, with the 20
people are more likely to say they have friends. This is what I talk about on college campuses all the time, about trying to have a relationship across racial lines. And what does it look like? I just was talking to a whole crowd of students a few months ago. And if you had, before I talked to them, if they'd said, oh, yeah, I got plenty of friends, after they said, well, OK, maybe not so much. You know, maybe it's not a water cooler buddy, but it's a, you know, snack in the cafeteria buddy or that kind of thing. What I think that young people bring to the table is that they would like to not come with some of the more traditional kinds of biases that they see exhibited by some of their parents. I think they work, you know, as much as they can against that. So if they figure, if I'm not doing that, if I'm not doing what my grandparents said or what I heard my father say, then I must not be that. But it really takes a little bit of work. Just the nature of the beast is that it takes a little bit of work because of what race is and has meant in America.
Well, I also think the thing with the young people is that schools are more, at least in some places, certainly than when I was growing up, integrated now. I mean, I grew up in Fall River, which is not a wealthy town, but it was interesting. All the dark-skinned Cape Verdeans were in New Bedford, and all the light-skinned Cape Verdeans were in Fall River. There was not a single two black kids in a high school class of 802. That's it, in the whole city. And I got to college, it was a different kind of experience, but I don't know what it was like for you growing up. It was not a very integrated public education.
Oh, I can remember vividly the day. I have this burned in my mind, and I should remember the name of the family because they were a big story in Rowayton, Connecticut, where I grew up. This mother came with her two little kids, and it was like right out of, you know, George Wallace, Alabama, and took these two little kids by the hands, walked them right up the front pathway to our totally segregated school, and said, I'm enrolling these two kids here today.
And you grew up in Tennessee. Now, were you in an integrated school, public school system?
I helped integrate the school. I was one of 19 students in a lawsuit against the city of Memphis to make
in a white school.
Yes, to make Memphis finally desegregate the schools. I mean, I'm really familiar with this.
But Kelly,
so you had been the raisin in the bowl of milk from many occasions.
Yeah. So I'm curious about your takeaway on this, though. That, I mean, does it stand to reason? Is it a comfort factor? What is it? Why don't people have more cross-racial
intimate friends?
Well, you know, something that Marjorie just mentioned is kind of a sad note to me, and that is we thought that, you know, when desegregation happened, and I say desegregation, not integration, there is a difference, then that people would be in school with each other. They would work together. And so naturally, if you're in those spaces, you develop those right. relationships. But what you find is that you really have to, as you would actually with any other friend, mm-hmm. You're going to have to go a little bit more because you're not friends with everybody in this building.
Right.
You're not friends with everybody that you live next door to. There takes something else, some commonality, mm-hmm. some movement from both of you to really go beyond the surface. And race is often still a blocking of that. So I'm not surprised by these numbers. And by the way, I'm not surprised by the numbers that say 25% of non-white Americans only have friends. As I, you know, my friendship circle, and remember, I use that advisedly, really looks like a rainbow coalition. And that is odd to some of my friends who would be in this 25% yeah. category who don't have anybody else.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Are you among the 40% of white Americans who do not have a single non-white friend, or are you not? And if you are a Asian American, Latino, African American, are you in that 25% group that whose friends are only in your group or not? Now, I want to know, before we take the calls here, we'll go to the calls in a second, do black boyfriends count? Because apparently
I had
you've
two black boyfriends. Does that count?
No. Really?
We're really good friends, Callie.
Yeah, I'm sure you were. You're buddies of a different
you
nature.
You exchanged several intimacies, which you won't go into
no.
right here. Okay.
Yeah,
all right,
on.
Never mind.
Yeah.
All right, well, the phones are lining
Pete
up here.
From Dedham, what do you think about this survey, Pete?
Well, I need to put it in perspective. I'm a 50-something who grew up in the South, both Texas and Kentucky. And when I grew up in the South, I had lots of real non-white friends that were real friends. And when transitioned up to the Northeast, which I think this survey probably shows, it was really surprising the change in attitudes. I found that a lot of people, a lot of whites in the Northeast, would never have someone who was a non-white friend. You know, the bigotry was sort of latent. It was sort of under the surface. And I just, with this, I found that to be a very palatable phenomenon when I've lived up there. Those of us who are from the South in this current survey are so low, but yet I'm of the generation where we were, I don't want to say we were trying to make a difference, but with integration in schools, that happened. And then when you get to the liberal Northeast, all of a sudden that seems to be, I believe this statistic, particularly living where I live now.
What do you about that, Cal? You're from the South?
Yes, and I would agree with you because we're mostly living. We had experiences cheek by jowl. I can't say enough about, though, the separation in housing. I mean, because that's still an issue. That
in
makes
Boston,
a huge
it's
difference.
Huge.
Even if you're in school or at work with people, what I've come to believe is that if you're not living around with, you know, there's something about that space that increases the possibility of their developing some commonalities and some other kinds of conversation. I mean, even if it's nothing more than, what do you think about that hedge out front? Mm-hmm. I might do, you know, then you start a conversation. I know that sounds crazy, but I agree with him because I have to say, I often remind people that I call this up South. So in terms of attitude.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
It means that, you know, the perception is that below the Mason-Dixon line, as this survey indicates, you know, fewer people who have cross-racial relationships, indicating that there's perhaps more bias and something blocking that. However, it's, you know, up here just because there's a veneer of stuff on top, a lot of this still exists. So up South, same thing. You know, you just have to navigate in the space that you're in. By the way, I want to add that pop culture has done little, in my opinion, to really articulate what real friendship looks like across racial lines. Though I want to give, as they say, a shout out to Kevin James when he did The King of Queens. In that,
what's The King of Queens?
King of Queens is a comedy series,
okay.
And he's a comedian. There was a black actor, Victor Williams, who played his best friend, and the wife played the best friend of Leah Remini. Leah Remini is best known for this role. And they were actually really friends. They socialized together. They worked together. They had fights along some racial lines in which the audience got a chance in a comedic way to understand what the differences and the commonalities were and what brought them together. That's really about the best you know, written episodes that I can think of out there in the world of fiction where I have seen it articulated well. Yeah. Most of the time, it's phony, phony, phony. Mm. In fact, years ago, I wrote an article about how I'm sick of these black friends as sidekicks to white main characters, and there's nothing about them that would suggest there is any relationship. It's phony. They're in the same room, so that makes them a friend.
Who is a white guy?
Oh, they're all over the place. You know, what I wrote the article about years ago was about Allie McBeal and her fictional black friend who knew nothing about her life. I said, "Oh wow, that's really a friend."
877-301-8970. We're talking about a new survey by Reuters, which says that 40% of white Americans have not a single solitary non-white friend. Sean from Dedham, what do you think, Sean?
Hi, how are you?
Whoops.
Echo.
Hey, Marjorie, how are you? I got a question. Was there a study also going to ask how many white friends that black people had? I mean, did it
It's in here.
It said 25% of, well, it didn't say, it wasn't African Americans or blacks. It was 25% of non-whites have no friends that are white. So, yeah, it's higher among whites.
Now, Marjorie, I might be wrong, but didn't Martin Luther King say, don't judge a man by the color of his skin? Why are we so worried about what color of skin our friends are? I'm not following this.
He's wondering why it's a big deal, Kelly.
We're not worried about it.
May I finish?
It's just to say that you have a richer experience if you know people a little better. And what the survey goes on to say is that this is a deliberate thing, that people don't have it, not because, hey, I don't know anybody, I didn't meet anybody, but because there are certain kinds of things that block a development of a relationship. So that's what we're talking about, is that race stands as a way to block a relationship. If you have a friend, you know, great. I certainly am enjoying the friendship of many people who are not black in my life, and that my life is richer for it. So I'm not one to say that's not a rich experience. We're just lamenting that there's not more of an exchange. And if there were, I think, then some of the issues that bubble up often in general around other major things and major news incidents or whatever maybe wouldn't happen. That's what we're saying.
Yeah. Oh, Sean, thank you for the call. But I absolutely think it's a big deal because of what you just said. I mean, the Trayvon Martin case was a classic example. I think white Americans had difficulty understanding, or at least some did, that this guy, even though he was this white Hispanic, is that what the term we use for George Zimmerman, I guess?
Yes. You know, well, that's how he described himself.
I mean, I don't think for a second that Zimmerman would have gone after this guy if he'd been a white kid with a hoodie. He just wouldn't have. And I think if you don't have these conversations, then you don't get that. And being a reporter, you know, one of the great things, I've been so lucky to be in the living rooms of many people, you know, who've lost kids and who live in difficult situations. You talk to these people, the understanding that you get from that, and this is different, that's my job, but the understanding you get from that is just priceless, I think.
Anyway. I mean, I think, first of all, I hold friendship in high regard, period. So, then to have a friendship that is cross-racial, you know, because I know the work and the effort that it takes for both sides to make it real, you know, I just really have a great appreciation for it.
All right. We're taking calls today. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. New Reuters poll says 40% of white Americans have no black friends, no friends of color. Not really that big a surprise. Alex in Newton. Go ahead, Alex.
Conversation. I'm Jewish, white, and I live in Newton, so I'm from the upper class. I do have black friends, and I think that it's really important to have friends of different races because you get a totally different perspective. Because just speaking about Trayvon Martin, with my white friends, they really don't understand being victimized. And I mean, unfortunately, anti-Semitism and racism are still alive and strong today. So I mean, I do understand what it's like to be victimized, and my black friends are able to comprehend that with me, and I'm able to understand their views about it. And I feel like some of my white friends that don't have black friends, they are completely blind to that issue.
Okay, now, Alex, are these black friends people that you socialize outside of the office? Do you have them over for dinner? Do you go play golf with them? What's the situation?
One of my friends, he actually took me to his family reunion down in North Carolina 2 years ago. I hang out with these guys like probably 2 or 3 times a week.
Right. Like, for real. That's good.
Outside of work. Yeah. These are like my boys. These are my real friends.
All right. There you go.
You know what is funny, and I think most black people, including myself, have rarely had this situation outside of work. I mean, I've had it in work, but outside of work, where you go to something, and you're the only white person there. I was at a birthday
party. And you always comment on it, by the way.
Well, no.
Stop commenting.
Well, I'm not commenting on it.
Not you, I mean.
I'm saying
the singular white person.
how weird I felt.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, am I doing things wrong? Am I acting? I mean, because you're not in that situation and you feel like you're conspicuous. And you feel like you're very conspicuous and that, oh my goodness.
And that's the way black people feel all the time.
Exactly.
Likely to be in that situation.
Well, yeah. What I meant was that usually what happens is the one white person in the group will say, wow, I'm the only white person in the group. Yeah, okay. We noticed.
Well, because you do feel so. It's fairly common for you, right?
Yes.
And I mean, it is not fairly common, particularly in Boston, for a white person to be the only white person.
And therein is where we're talking about this poll.
Yeah.
That's
at a birthday party or at a reunion or at anything else. And you're thinking, you know, am I dressed correctly? Or, you know.
Oh, for God's sake.
I do. 877-301-8970. 40% of white people say they have no non-white friends. Shauna from Northborough. What do you think, Shauna?
This is a terrific show. I'm really enjoying it. It's funny because I was just thinking the other day about this topic, even before I heard about this. Callie, I'm also from Memphis. And I moved here 13 years ago. And I had a lot of really great African-American friends, but I left when I went to college, and I married a white man. Now, since we've been here, I got to tell you, it's been really, really difficult to find African-American friends who are close enough, you know, who can get that close relationship that you're talking about. You know, I did have one friend, but then some things didn't happen. I felt like maybe there was some mistrust of my white husband. I don't know, but I find that my closest friends, the ones that I can really hang out with and share things with, are not black.
Now, you're referring to your husband as white. Are you not white?
I'm sorry. I am. I'm black. Yeah.
Okay.
I was part of that whole desegregation thing too. I was bused 45 minutes from my house to an all white school, pretty much.
You know what I think is interesting, because in my circle of friends, I have a number of friends who are married, you know, to someone outside of their race, and you know, they're just part of the group. I mean, they've been part of the group, you know, maybe, and they've always felt very comfortable. So I don't know if that's something they worked on before or whatever, but I've never sensed any uncomfortableness. So that's an interesting, and there are a lot of people here who are interracial couples in Boston. Yes. You'll see a lot of those.
But
around.
Isn't there a class issue here too? When you cut right to it, I mean,
I don't believe that.
I don't know. She lives in Northborough. I mean, you marry a white guy, and suddenly you're. I don't know. You're not living.
Well, if you live in Dorchester, obviously there's a lot more, you know, integration in Dorchester. Yeah. There's, you know, white and black. I mean, you live in Wellesley.
Well, there's more African Americans there, if that's what you mean. But, you know, or other people outside of being white. But I don't think it's a. I mean, that's not been my experience. I mean, people either want to develop a relationship or not. And so I know people who are very well off and people who are not, who have very good friends across racial lines, and others who just do not. Again, I will come back to the housing issue about where people live, and some people tend to group together to live. Sometimes then puts you out of a space in which you may have an opportunity to develop a relationship outside of kind of the water cooler situation.
We have an email from Paul from Milton. And by the way, I'm remiss in reading and giving the email address. It is BPR at WGBH.org. Paul from Milton says, the old chestnut still applies. Down south, they don't care how close the blacks get as long as they don't get too high. Up north, they don't care how high the blacks get as long as they don't get too close.
Oh, that's an interesting one. I've heard that before.
Yeah, he says sad, but still true. Is that still true?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's just an interesting poll to take at this time.
Yeah.
I think because I think I do really believe that the generations coming behind are really trying to have a different perspective on it, even if they are hurt then when something like Trayvon Martin happens, because there was actually shock waves in communities where I think people would feel hey, that's not been my experience. I've not had this experience. I've got good friends across racial lines. And what does this mean then for me, too? I may have mentioned I was very impressed by a young white woman that did a video right after the Trayvon Martin case and two other white kids and said, we should stop wearing T-shirts that say, I am Trayvon Martin. We are not. We're in a different situation. But here's where we are. We understand and support. Yeah. It was from her perspective. She's quite young. And I thought, wow, this is interesting.
But I think the difference is now with kids under 30, because the schools are more integrated, or there's Metco, or there's busing of kids, then you make friendships in school. And that experience for a lot of young people growing up is they keep those friendships.
I got to say, a very wise woman said to me a long time ago in a corporate setting, proximity does not mean relationship.
Right.
So you can be in the same space as we all are, as we're talking about being adults in the same space, and yet there is still, you know, obstacles to that.
Yeah,
so there has something else has to happen.
But I think you do see that with young people.
Yeah,
they're on this, that they are really genuinely good friends.
My daughter and some of her friends.
Yeah, because they were in this juxtaposition where I might not have been, I wasn't, and you weren't either, and you had to go to the white school, which must have been really weird.
Well, that's a long other ugly story, but it wasn't fun. Let's just say high school wasn't fun.
Okay, 877-301-89. So we're going to take a few more calls here. Let's go to, where are we going? To Ben in Somerville. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Marjorie. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, so I just wanted to give I heard the caller earlier, and the reason why I called in was mainly to in part ways address what he was saying, where he said that, and I'm not meaning to judge or attack in any way, but when he said that, you know, basically, why are we talking about race at this issue? I think that's just a naive viewpoint, and it's a viewpoint that I kind of grew up with. I grew up in a small rural area. I didn't even know what a black person looked like until I moved into a more populated area, and I ended up bringing home one of my black friends to my grandma, and she said point blank, you know, don't ever bring this bad word I'm not going to say to my house again. And I was like, what's the matter, grandma? Why can't I bring home this friend? And from that point on, being a white male growing up, and now I have a black partner, my boyfriend, 5 years, we're first time practically married, might as well be. He knows everything about me. Of course, he's my partner, and I had a black roommate. I had all these people. I immediately immersed myself into this environment, and the whole Trayvon Martin case for someone on it is just a case of where people just don't understand. Being on the other side, me being a white person, I understand how privileged I am to be white. And I don't take that for granted. And I think it's just unreal and unrealistic for us to live in a world right now where we can sit back and say race just doesn't matter. And it just makes me angry to see people that just don't even see that.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Thank you, Ben. That was a great call. Let's go to Chris in Cape Cod. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. I grew up in an area of New York that was very diverse. And as a young child, I had tons of friends from various ethnicities. And I still cherish those friendships, and we still see each other from time to time. I then went on to a very diverse university in Boston, where once again I was in the same situation.
Which one is that?
I went to Boston University.
Okay.
And though maybe not diverse with respect to black or white, I actually got on the elevator many days, and I felt like, whoa, I'm the one who doesn't belong here. Because I didn't speak European languages, or I wasn't from Asia. And now I find myself on Cape Cod, where the fact that I don't have a close friend at this stage in my life has nothing to do with my closed-mindedness. It just happens to be that I'm in an area where it's not a diverse culture here. And quite frankly, sometimes I miss the diversity. It's sometimes painful for me not to have my children being introduced actively to different cultures. And we do go out of our way to do that, but I feel the survey is kind of slighted because there are just people in life who don't necessarily come across the gift of diversity.
You know what? I think actually the survey is not talking about you, honestly. I think the survey is talking about people who never have had this in their lives, not you're feeling like, you know, as a result of geography and some other life circumstances, it's not that you haven't had other relationships with people sometime in your life. But so first, that's what I want to say. I mean, the other thing to say is that I keep hearing a little bit of this underneath about race doesn't matter, color doesn't matter, blah, blah, blah. About the worst thing you can tell somebody of a different race is that I don't see your race. Color blindness is ridiculous.
Oh, I hate that phrase. That's ridiculous.
That is ridiculous. I want to appreciate you and the fullness of who you are, and I would hope that you would do the same. And by the way, I know I'm black, and I enjoy being black. It's okay. So let's start from
We've
there. So let's start from there. But no, I'm saying this, and you know, we're making fun of it, but a lot of people struggle around this, thinking, well, if I notice it or say something about it, that makes me a bad person. And no, it doesn't, because I'm recognizing if you're a friend of mine and you're not black and white, I appreciate the fullness of who you are and what that means as well.
Right.
So, I mean, we have to, that's what I mean about, you know, getting to a point of depth where you're really having conversations with people and talking about these issues. And I don't think that for a lot of people, they get very far with it. Listen, I'm thrilled that we're at least at the point in my life where people are in some spaces together. So that's not foreign. But we can see from these conversations and from this survey that, you know, it doesn't go as deep as one would like, because if it goes deep, then I think our whole society would be in a little bit different situation now.
All right, we can take one more call here, Marjorie.
I think we're out of time.
Oh, we're out of time.
We're out of time. I'm sorry, you guys. We didn't get to take any more calls.
Yeah, those are really good calls, though.
Oh, they
are? All right, you can catch Kelly Crossley Sunday nights at 6:30 for her radio show, Under the Radar. Looking forward to that, Kelly. So is it good news for the newspaper business that two men outside of the industry have bought two of the nation's biggest papers? Chris Lydon joins us next for that conversation. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
News happens. It can be anywhere.
To dissolve the Constitution on a temporary basis.
On PRI's The World, we look for second opinions, unusual angles.
No, you cannot do that. This is democracy.
We help you think through the day's events.
There's no question that what the violence that we saw overnight is a step in the wrong direction.
PRI's The World. It's your world.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org. And Tanglewood, Bernard Haitink leads the BSO in their last concert of the season, Beethoven Symphony No. 9, Sunday, August 25th. More information available at tanglewood.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Emily Rooney is filling in for Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. We hear constantly that the newspapers are dying any day now. But could Jeff Bezos and John Henry be the unlikely lifeline that the industry needs? Is it a good thing that two savvy businessmen who are not newspaper guys have just bought two huge ones, the Boston Globe and the Washington Post? Christopher Lydon, the man behind RadioOpenSource.org, has been thinking a lot about this, and he's with us here in Studio 3. You guys can weigh in on this as well at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Do you still get your news from newspapers, reading the newspaper every day, or is newspaper the business, the whole thing, the paper product dead to you? Are you online, magazines, Twitter, cable TV, your iPad, whatever it is? Christopher Lydon,
Thank you
very much for being here. And I think you are optimistic. Are you optimistic?
Well, in a funny sort of upside down way. I mean, we've been living this story, alas, all of us, with some, you know, as newspaper people, in this kind of endless trend storm in media. What I just would say about John Henry and Jeff Bezos and the newspapers is I'm so thrilled that they're not newspaper people. And, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, the Jacks, Jack Connors, Jack Welch, wanted to buy the Globe. They were ready to pay $500 million.
Crazy, naive. No, it just sold for $70.
Because it was really because they wanted, these were Irish kids from the hood who wanted to be the tailors, who wanted to sort of call the tune on what is going on in Boston. It's a very sentimental and completely over kind of fantasy about the newspaper.
Well, they weren't newspaper people either.
No, they weren't. But they had a dream of being sort of masters of information. Jack Connors already was in a certain way. And in the business world, you could say Jack Welch was a kind of media star, too. But the point is simply that the newspapers, I think they died 10 years ago or more. And they've been dragging us all through this. The only story they're really passionate about nowadays is their own sort of serial obituary. They are over. Oh, and they're also extremely...
Oh, please.
No, I mean it. They're also extremely unreliable, even about their own story. They don't tell the media story. The story they would have us believe is that... You know, one of the great, vital, important constitutional free speech, institutions, industries of our world is suffering a kind of bad sickness, and the numbers are not good. What they don't tell you is that the Globe was sold for basically in this transaction with John Henry for basically 3, 4, 5 cents on the dollar of what the New York Times paid for it. You know, if somebody told you, we'll give you 3 cents on the dollar of for your house, for what you paid 20 years ago, we'll give you 3 cents.
Or the Red Sox.
But you'd say, has the neighborhood changed that much? Is there something constitutionally wrong? And you would also recognize, quote, that the end is near. That's the main thing they don't tell you, is that this business has lost its audience, I think it's lost its intellectual integrity. It's lost its firepower.
Hold on.
Wait,
it hasn't lost its audience because its audience is online.
It hasn't lost its firepower either.
I mean, people are reading the newspapers, but they're reading them online. The Times does pretty well online. The Boston
Globe
and the Herald, many other things, Marjorie, online.
And they don't – I don't think – and maybe I should just speak for myself. I don't think they come to the New York Times brand, say, or the Globe brand – with the enthusiasm, the respect, the amusement, the hunger that we used to.
They get 29 million hits a month, the New York Times, on the website.
What does that number mean?
That means a lot of people are checking in at the New York Times.
Including me. And it's a valuable service, and some of it's very, very good. On the other hand, 29 million means almost nothing, Marjorie. The Globe, it turns out, has only 39,000 online subscribers. That's nothing.
Paid subscriber. But the people like me get it both ways because I'm a subscriber online, but I get it at home. So you got to count both of those. I want to ask you about the ownership thing here because I agree with you. I think it's great. I think, though, and I wonder if you agree, that John Henry is in a stickier situation than Jeff Bezos because – he's got
and
the
we're
Red
in a
Sox.
Sticky situation because we know so much less about him. Okay.
Yeah, and
right,
but
he's a suspicious character, he lives
in the backyard. You know, he lives in Brookline. I mean, he can't come in with a bulldozer. He's got to have a sensitivity, you know, to the people inside the building, to the readers, and he's got, you know, it's a sticky wicket with the Red Sox coverage. Although, of course, Brian McGrory and everybody else says he's not going to mess with that, but it's different, don't you think?
Yeah, it's always different. I think, though, that he took – I mean, the good thing about John Henry is that he took a very fresh look at Fenway Park, which I remember the Globe wise men wanted to raise. They wanted to put it on the harbor, all these crazy ideas. He put Larry Lucchino in to take a very, very clean broom at both the baseball operation and the way that park looks. He transformed the Red Sox experience, and he won 2 World Series titles. I think that kind of very tough-minded, break the pattern, start anew, new goals, would serve the Globe very, very well. Jeff Bezos is the more radical case because he is by now an incredibly rich but deeply experienced master of the digital transformation. And the Washington Post will be something hugely different. I mean, the other thing that newspapers don't tell you is it's a long time since the Pentagon Papers or Woodward and Bernstein and these glorious accomplishments that we grew up on and the reasons we love them. The fact is, I mean, to me, I just have to put this out. The world changed with the election of George W. Bush. We pride ourselves on an independent press, First Amendment. You can say anything you want, basically, about public figures. Not one newspaper in this country asterisked that president. They asterisked Roger Maris because he had a longer batting season than Babe Ruth when he broke that record. And it was always Roger Maris. But asterisk. Nobody ever said, wait a sec, George Bush was not elected. He was selected by the Supreme Court of the United States. And that deserves a special category.
But
similarly, hang on just one sec.
Okay.
On the march to war in Iraq, every single newspaper endorsed it, including the Times and the Washington Post and the Boston Globe.
There has been great. I'm going to defend newspapers here because there has been great work since George Bush was elected in newspapers. They goofed big time on the war in Iraq, no question about it.
We're talking trillion-dollar historic, generationally.
But what I don't buy, and I think you can look at the newspaper coverage of the Boston Marathon here, both the Boston Herald, and we have far fewer people than the Globe. We did great coverage on that. The Globe did great coverage on that. Now, you could say, do we do enough coverage on, you know, the FBI and how they were involved with Whitey Bulger? Maybe we did, maybe we didn't. I think the problem is newspapers have become too expensive to run because you have to have presses, you have to have trucks, you have to have paper, you have all these things, and you can't get the ads. I think it's very clear what's happening. People are going online to get their news. But come on, Christopher Lydon, who is driving the news cycle every day?
It's the newspapers.
Maybe you could argue
that Politico has hurt the Washington Post dramatically because they are a great political website, and lots of people that might go to the Washington Post for their political news are now going to the Politico instead, and they've done a great job. Those guys were from the Post, I believe, were they not? The guys that started
Mike
Politico,
Allen.
But newspapers still drive the news. I disagree with you.
If you hang among newspaper people, Marjorie,
I hear on the radio as well.
Of course, and you hang with media people, you hear the media line. I find on the street that that stuff has less and less resonance.
So who's driving the news then?
Well, I think people drive their own news, and they find their own news where they're interested. I found myself falling into this pattern of basically finding the neighborhood news on Facebook and finding the global news on The Guardian site. I find my brainiac news on a site called Three Quarks Daily, which is a compilation of marvelous writing about almost everything, music, philosophy, literature. But I found my war coverage, for example, through the Iraq War with Juan Cole on something called Informed Comment. He's a history professor at University of Michigan. But people
spell Three Quarks for people that are listening, if they want to go
Three
look at that.
Three Quarks, Quarks.
Thank you.
And it's just a brilliant thing.
It's
put together by a whole chain of wonderfully diverse intellectuals. But at the core of it, it's seven brothers and sisters,
Pakistani
doctors.
With all due respect, you're in another world. I mean, when you talk about the things that
a lot of people are interested in
basic things like the Aaron Hernandez story, and that becomes water cooler, and they go to the newspapers today. There was a terrific piece in the Boston Globe about the background of Aaron Hernandez.
Mental health.
These are the things that people talk about. How about that probation department scandal story? That seeped out everywhere. That became just... It was molecular. It went everywhere. Anywhere you went, people were talking about it. Where do you think it came from? It came from a terrific investigation by the Boston Globe.
You'd be amazed how few people I meet that are following the Aaron Hernandez case. I mean,
like I said,
football
you're in
player
world.
Went berserk.
Which world is he in?
Well, I don't know.
There are many worlds, and there's room for many worlds.
He's in Elysium. He's in that movie where he's going to the...
Well, let me give out the number here if people want to weigh in on this. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, or the email address is bpr@wgbh.org. Do you agree with Christopher Lydon? He's basically saying people don't get the news from the newspapers anymore. It's not just that the print product is dead. It's that the newspapers itself are dead. I think that one of the things Jeff Bezos is talking about with the Washington Post, though, is personalizing the news. Mm-hmm. So if you are a sports junkie, you are a probation department state scandal junkie, you are whatever kind of junkie, you can get that sort of thing. But what do you guys think about
this? It's not just about my profession or my office or my narrow thing. I think people deeply want to know about other places, other perspectives. But they want to get it in a non-institutional way. That, to me, is the key, Marjorie. Institutional journalism that speaks for, you know, Walter Cronkite used to say, that's the way it is, after 20 minutes of pictures and words mm-hmm. about the world. And nowadays, people would rise up and say, Walter, we love you, but that's not the way it is. I live on Main Street, or I live in Detroit or wherever, and you haven't been here for as long as one can remember. We have different perspectives, and the internet, you know, irreversibly changes that perspective. People can both express themselves and they can find information that they're passionately hungry for on their own. Thank you, and I adored Walter Cronkite. But similarly, the New York Times pretense that this is all the news that's fit to print, much less without fear or favor.
Right.
This has been...
There's more.
Right.
This is over.
On the Bezos thing. He's going to figure out a way to print the Washington Post not using presses. And that is what's going to be the money saver there, because this is an antiquated system. You can't be doing this, running every single copy, you know, hundreds of thousands of newspapers through a press. There's going to be some mass form of digital printing.
That's easy.
He's going to have to come up with
it. The idea of trucks in the middle of the night delivering papers to your doorstep to tell you something that you knew at 11 o'clock last night on your computer is absurd. Let's just, you know, put it aside.
Mm-hmm.
And moreover, he's also going to think of new ways to serve a tremendous human hunger for information and news and wisdom and gossip and trends and that stuff. So it's not as if we're going to get stupid. The other thing that there's a wonderful guy, John Perry-Bala, who had this wonderful line about this was 10 years ago or more, but he would say, how is it that the New York Times can only write one headline about the web, and that is internet, colon, threat or menace? The newspaper industry would want you to believe that, like, the lights are going out if we can't deliver our papers. No, the lights are going on all over.
I think the newspapers are trying to figure out how to make money online, and that's what they're doing. They realize there aren't going to be any print newspapers in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever it is, and we're trying to make money online. Mm. I mean, that's what my daughter did all summer at the New York Times as a business school student, try to figure out how the New York Times can make money online. But let's take some phone calls here.
Please.
Greg in the car on the way to the Cape. We'll get a traffic report as
well. Yeah, exactly.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Greg.
Yeah, the traffic is clearing up, thank goodness. Thank you for the show, and thank you also for the prior topic on race. I thought that was very, very interesting.
So
you're welcome. We wanted to keep talking.
I have two comments. I agree with the speaker that you know, it's unlikely to be kind of parochial newspaper guys who are going to solve the problems of newspaper media. So I actually think it's refreshing that you have two visionaries who, you know, are really data guys, right? I mean, John Henry revolutionized, you know, baseball, not just the Red Sox, by looking at data and not just looking at kind of the way things used to be done. And you could make the same comment about Jeff Bezos and you know, revolutionizing the way that we, I mean, gosh, he used to be a book guy, right? And that's not what he is anymore. So that was comment number one. And comment number two is, you know, it's interesting how we used to think about radio, right? How many people have called the demise of radio, and here we are on a radio show talking about...
Thank God.
You know, the issues...
Keep calling, Greg.
So, you know, we're looking at you know, major demographic trends and a whole generation of people who, you know, grew up with the tactile sensation of flipping through, you know, a soup-to-nuts newspaper. And I read the Wall Street Journal every day, and I read the paper journal, and I always will, because I can get kind of all the things that I'm interested in, not just little bits. And I can get my bits from the internet because I know where to get the very specific micro bits. But that's what a newspaper is all about. It's a tactile experience where you can get, you know, in this polarized culture that we live in, you know, you can get the right and the left and everything in the middle and make up your own mind of where you stand, you know, within this polarized culture. So I'll shut up now.
Greg,
very well said, Greg.
And
those Jeff Bezos will find you. So will John Henry. They want you.
Do you know this? Amanda did a little thing, a bio on John Henry and Jeff Bezos. That Jeff Bezos, at 3 years old, tried dismantling his crib. And a couple of years later, he rigged an electrical alarm to go off if his siblings tried to enter his room. He's a guy that can monetize the newspapers. What do you think, Chris? I think he can.
It's not about the newspapers. I mean, take
paper out of it. He'll monetize the newspapers online, the news, the Washington Post online.
He will rethink our appetite for information, and he will, I'm sure, it took him a while with Amazon, he will surely find a way to make it pay. But I don't think it helps really to think about this as just a money-making project. I think we have a revolutionary technology for connecting each other with information, with news, with ideas. And it's extraordinarily democratic. Anybody can speak. I can make a radio show on my computer. I do it all the time. And I can be heard in Burma as fast as I'm heard in Billerica. This is a dramatic – and there's no paper involved. I mean, just – and that's with maybe – $300 worth of equipment from Radio Shack. This is a new world. And it's not as if we're checking out on interest in other things. There are just faster, different ways to do it. And Jeff Bezos will have, you know, a million ideas for every one I have to make it work. Mm.
Yeah, the thing here is, though, there is still a news gathering process. I don't need to tell you that or Marjorie. And you have to have the feet, the eyes, the ears on the ground. And my favorite comment is, and in fact, there's a caller who says, I haven't read a newspaper in decades. The internet is in. Where do you think the internet gets that news from? Half of these people aggregate it. They take it from the Washington Post. They take it from the Boston Globe. They take it from the New York Times. They aggregate it and they put it out on the internet. Somebody was your eyes and ears on the ground. Somebody was the original reporter who actually got the information that made it to that screen.
Emily, I got to fight back here. Most people, a great deal of the news, so-called news in circulation, comes from a newspaper reporter at some point. At the same time, a great deal of that information is wrong. I mean, we learned in the Iraq War that well into the
war— Not a great deal. I'm going to push back on that.
Well, we can—
I think we can concede Iraq. Let's concede Iraq.
Iraq is still an incredible live wound in this society.
Yes, but
But the point was simply 70% of the people thought Saddam Hussein was behind the attack
on
9/11.
We were told that.
Okay. We were told that by newspaper people. We were told that by William Sapphire and Tom Friedman in the New York Times. The newspapers have been an enormous source of mis- and disinformation.
But wait a minute. Christopher Lydon, in World War II, they were conspiring to lie about World War II, and everybody knew it was going on. We were only reporting the stuff that was going to make us look good. So this is not like something new. And I would argue that in the Iraq War, it was not that we were there was a lot of confusion about the Iraq War. I think
it wasn't
we should
not
use
newspaper
that
newspaper wanted.
They
didn't
confusion.
Want
it.
No, they didn't want. You think Judith Miller wanted to have it wrong?
I think she was misled.
She was misguided.
Thomas Friedman did not want to have it wrong. Lots of people goofed, but let's not use that. Let's do something.
Who says she wanted to get it right?
No.
Did the newspaper do those things to assure that it was right? Did Mike Barnicle want to get the Bulger story right?
Yes.
I don't think so.
Oh, yes.
No.
He just wrote a piece about it in Time magazine and said that, and for people that don't know, Mike Barnicle wrote columns saying that Whitey Bulger prevented drugs from going into South Boston. He wrote in Time Inc. just the other day that actually he was Billy Bulger, who the Senate president said, "You're absolutely wrong, Mike. You don't know what you're talking about. I live in South Boston, blah, 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 blah." So Mike Barnicle was blaming Billy Bulger. I don't know what.
Billy Bulger for what?
For dissuading him from the notion that Whitey Bulger was bringing drugs into South Boston. But let's talk about something you mentioned before, the coverage of the marathon or the coverage of Hernandez. You need news reporters. They can be from whatever medium you want, but usually they're from the newspaper going out and doing the firsthand reporting on crime, murders, the stuff that goes on in your neighborhood.
The law.
You can have business. You can have what's the thing that's the thing that's in everybody's town now? That little
patch.
The patch. The patch goes out, I think, themselves.
Yeah,
they just
decimated the patch.
Okay, let's take some phone calls here. Sam in Malden, you're on with Christopher Lydon, and we're having a heated discussion here where Christopher Lydon is attacking the newspaper business and Emily and I are defending
Saying
it.
Saying a fond farewell to it, more, Sam.
Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'd say I think Emily's got it dead wrong. I think Chris has got it dead right. The newspapers, you know, you self-select who you want to write for. I mean, I look for the New York Times occasionally for a particular article, but the Snowden example is a good one. He didn't go to the New York Times or the Post. He knew that was not a trustworthy organization. He went to Glenn Greenwald. He didn't go to the Guardian. He went to Glenn Greenwald, and if Glenn Greenwald wasn't working at the Guardian, he'd go to Glenn Greenwald somewhere else.
Glenn Greenwald is not a reporter. He's not a reporter. He's not a journalist. That's why he went there.
He has no responsibility.
He didn't have. He's not a reporter. He's not.
There's no such thing as a reporter.
There isn't?
No.
God, I was in South
Boston. He's not
a
news person.
Glenn Greenwald
does not qualify.
He qualifies magnificently. I mean, seriously, does Glenn Greenwald not qualify and Tom Friedman does? I mean, a hustler for the Iraq War.
He's a columnist.
He goofed. He goofed in Iraq big time. He's humiliated,
he over
I'm sure.
And over and over. And Glenn Greenwald has brought a very independent citizen judgment, which every journalist can learn from.
Herb from Boston. What do you think, Herb?
Well, I honestly believe that Chris has it correct.
This is terrible, Emily. We're losing here.
Hello?
This is the same guy who said newspapers' time is come and gone. The internet is in. Where do you think the internet gets it from, Herb? I honestly believe that
with the number of outlets to where we can get our information,
you know, print media, it's going by the way of the dinosaur. And, you know, there are so many people that are getting it from reporters at, you know, the Times and the Post and the Globe, but the flair, the voice, the things that are, you know, attracting a lot of the millennial generation, they are going for the internet, for Politico, you know, Current, which is Al Jazeera, I believe now.
Herb, I want to thank you, but also just to underline the point that you say flair and voice. This is absolutely required, and it's what the newspapers lost. I mean, when they speak as institutions, we used to love it. The majesty of the New York Times, the weight of the New York Times, we thought the wisdom of the New York Times, and sometimes it was wisdom, but it's been lost in a kind of embarrassed institutional, you know, fudging of everything. It's those clear, resonant, fresh, honest, individual voices that we prize now, and I think that's progress.
Okay. Thank you for the call, Herb. 877-301-8970. We're talking about the purchase of the Boston Globe by John Henry, who, of course, owns the Red Sox, and the purchase of the Washington Post by Jeff Bezos, who the guy who started Amazon and dismantled his crib, or tried to at the age of three, which I find it very impressive.
And he's got a clock under the mountain somewhere that ticks every 10,000 years. Yeah.
You know, I do agree with you, Christopher Lydon, this far, that I think it is really exciting that these digital guys, these sort of visionaries and geniuses in the digital age of John Henry, maybe a little bit less because he came up in the futures, or what was his thing? He was
pork belly.
Soybeans
or
pork belly. But Bezos especially, because he's looking at it differently than a guy, you know, than the Taylor family would have if they bought the Globe again. So I do find that's exciting. I guess I do agree with you that the print itself, we're going. I mean, we are going. What I don't agree with you, though, is that I still maintain that I've been doing the radio for a long time and you've been doing television for a long time, that the original reporting is still done by the newspapers for the most part. And it drives me nuts that the reporters on the ground covering the murders, covering the RNC people down here at the Westin Hotel in Boston today, covering all those stories in depth, they should get some credit.
Well, of course they should. We should also be using the new media to make a direct connection with the mayhem, the bloodshed in Cairo today. This can be done much better than it is. On the matter of the coverage of the marathon, it was a devastating story and an extraordinarily important one in Boston's sort of self-awareness and many dimensions. At the same time, we've talked about this on this program, I fault the media in general for seeing it in such a narrow way. To me, the Boston Marathon story was a kind of blowback, as I said at the time, a parody, a kind of a malicious joke version of our predator drones abroad. This happens every day. And the same week of the Boston Marathon killing of three people, 17 people, it was in the New York Times inside the paper on the same day as the Charnayev brothers were on the front page, 17 people, 15 children were killed in Afghanistan, and we saw in a picture this extraordinary, just heartbreaking row of little graves of anonymous kids, had nothing to do with anything, killed by American drones. To me, to see the marathon story in isolation from a pattern of, you know, racial profiling.
Okay. Hold on for 1 second. You are not telling me that you believe that Tamerlan Tsarnaev blew up people on Boylston Street because he was really upset. I mean, the more I know about Tamerlan Tsarnaev, he had some screws loose there.
Lots of screws loose.
Okay.
But no, I'm saying to see that tragedy in our beloved Copley Square on Marathon Day, which is a virtually sacred holiday, in isolation from what our military, our CIA, our president endorses in Yemen and Afghanistan and Pakistan.
It's not in isolation. It's all there. And it's, you know, this is an extraordinary event, out of the ordinary. It's like saying,
and of course,
you know, we don't do the same coverage of, you know, murders in the black community. We're all aware of that. But, you know, not every news story ranks equally. You know, you've been in editorial positions where you had to decide. You anchored the 10 o'clock news. This is the one we're going to tell you about first. And then we're going to tell you this. We're going to tell you that. And that's just the way it is.
Well, we are a little bit concerned about the United States over, I mean, we our knowledge of the rest of the world is pretty dim compared to other countries. But I don't buy the Tsarnaev's argument for a second. I think that it had anything to do with anything we're doing with drones or anything else. Other peoples may have. I don't think they did. I don't give them that much credit.
I think the weakness of, well, the flaw in some magnificent coverage of the marathon to me was a tendency toward a kind of narcissism and a sort of sentimentalism about Boston, as if we and our victims are alone in the world.
Well, that's a good point.
Simply not the case.
That's a point. And I think we were not tough enough on police. We didn't look, I don't think, and we still haven't as difficult as we should.
Can we take one call from somebody who might kind of agree with me?
Okay. Let's go.
Jackie.
Last call.
Jackie from Attleboro. Go ahead, Jackie.
Hi. So I just wanted to say about this, I'm like a pretty young person, very into the internet and everything. But I don't think that this is a really clear, the newspapers as organizations are bad and the internet is good.
Oh, good.
And, you know, I think that there's some sort of validation that comes with like a newspaper as an organization that the internet doesn't have, where, you know, I understand that that also sort of opens up criticism, where if the New York Times or the Boston Globe prints something that isn't true, then we all turn around and say, well, that's not right. But if the internet is something that's not true, we say, well, it's the internet. Why would you trust it? You know, anything could be false on the internet. And
bingo.
I think that kind of comparing.
And most of it is.
Like that.
to use Chris Lydon's hyperbole, most of what you read on the internet is bogus.
That's right, Chris Lydon. Defend that. What about TMZ?
The internet challenges you to sort of caveat emptor, as the Romans would say, buyer beware, inspect it. Shake it, look at it, test it. The newspaper would tell you, oh, that's all the news that's fit to print. That's a huge fallacy, too.
All right. Chris Lydon.
Jackie, thank you.
This was a great discussion, Christopher
Lydon. As always.
Even though I
nobody
disagree.
Got hurt.
Nobody got hurt.
Good luck, John Henry. Continue. Good luck, Jeff Bezos. Good luck, readers everywhere.
Okay. All right. Chris Lydon joins us every Thursday at 1 for Open Mic, but you can keep in touch with him 24/7 at radioopensource.org. All right. So is it time for the NEA, business loans, and angel investors to move over and make room for Kickstarter? Kara Miller brings us that conversation next on Boston Public Radio. This is 89.7 WGBH.
I'm James Edwards. I live here in Brighton, and I report here in Boston. I do this because of the accountability.
The Cambridge salary is far and away the highest in the state. And I would say that one of the reasons for that is that it is the largest, probably most complex, urbanized environment in the state that has a city manager form of government.
Me sticking with journalism is sort of the work and kind of that sense of public good in a way. James Edwards, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Bentley, the Mafra Trom Bead Project for at-risk children in Ghana, is anything but typical. It's part of a social enterprise designed and implemented by a group of students from Bentley University. Bentley, the business university. And Leap, a full-service branding agency for organizations in applied sciences, life sciences, higher education, and financial services. Leap, the branding agency for innovators. More online at leapwith.us.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I've calmed down. We hear a lot about Kickstarter, from the arts to the sciences. Kickstarter is where people are turning for funds. And here with us in Studio 3 to go over what Kickstarter can offer and what its limitations are is Kara Miller, host of Innovation Hub. Hi, Kara.
Hi, Marjorie and Emily.
We also want to tell people, before Kara explains what Kickstarter is, for those of you who are way ahead and are using Kickstarter right now, we'd love to hear from you and find out what you're raising money for at 877-301-8970 or 877-301-8970, and whether you're giving money to Kickstarter or contributing to projects at 877-301-8970.
All right, give us a primer. You guys were just talking about the upsides, the downsides of technology, right? And I think one of the really interesting things about Kickstarter is we used to wait for products to appear in the store, right? The CEO of 3M came up with this stuff, or GE, or, you know, The Limited, or Gap, right? They came up with what they wanted to come up with, and, you know, they hoped you liked it. Now, There is this thing called crowdsourcing and crowdfunding where people can come up with their own ideas for here is a product, whether it's a game or some kind of a vehicle or whatever, an art project that I want to exist in the world. And I'm going to put it out there and I'm going to try to get it funded. And I mean, I think that's really interesting. So that the idea is it shifted from a sort of top down thing where they said, yeah, OK, well, we're Procter & Gamble and we're making whatever okay. and we hope you like it, to something different.
The part I don't understand about this is it all altruism? So if I want to invest in Marjorie's movie or some product that you're – what do I get out of it?
Nothing. No tax deduction.
Nothing.
No. So that's not true, actually. So Kickstarter started with these little projects. And very often people would give something as a thank you gift. They give you a T-shirt that's saying, like, I supported this. Also, if people are trying to create something physical – for example, I went on today and I saw, okay, what's around Brighton, Massachusetts, where we are right now? Somebody who was trying to raise money for a board game, to create a board game. Actually, they needed $8,000. So far, they've gotten $18,000. So obviously, there's a lot of interest in this board game. And what are they giving people for supporting them? The board game. I mean, obviously, if you're supporting them, you're interested in this board game. So what do you get? You get one,
but you don't
two,
get
three.
A piece of it.
No, you don't.
Get I don't understand this.
But tell the story about this guy, this audio engineer, this Earl character that we have the story about that wanted to start his this guy. Do you know about him?
No, I think I sent you a bunch of different articles about different people.
This is audio engineer, and he wanted to have his dream of making his own album, a jazz electronica thing. And what he did was not just offer people the album, but for 30 bucks, you get a lesson with him because he's a great artist. For 50 bucks, you get the lesson, you get the album. Then for more money, he'd invite you over to his house, have dinner with him and his wife, talk about music all day long. So a lot of people want to be included in this sort of artsy
and
kind of bohemian scene.
That is very typically how they're structured. So, like I said, I went on today. There's a guy from Chelsea trying to raise money, the Aberdeen Woodshop Project, to have a shop that features the work of craftspeople. For $25, he'll mention you on his website. For $500, he'll make you a bookcase. For $1,000, he'll make you a copper drawer side table. So there's this sort of tiered thing. But then you have really big people who recently have gotten into this.
Yeah, Spike Lee.
Spike Lee. For $10,000, he'll go to dinner with you and sit with you in a courtside seat at the Knicks.
Oh, boy.
Right? So, you know, so there's little things and then there's bigger things. And he's raised $1 million so far. He's aiming for a million and a quarter. Yeah, exactly.
So there's a cutoff date on all these things, too, right?
Yeah. So it's all or nothing. If you do not make the amount of money that you say, my goal is $20,000 or my goal is $1 million. You say that right off the beginning. And if you don't get that money, it's all or nothing.
Right.
Then nobody contributes anything to you.
It's all pledged, Kara. How do you collect?
So it's, you know, through PayPal. So you might pledge me $25, but your credit card does not get charged until by Kickstarter, the company. They are monitoring me until I reach my goal, right? Because you don't want to give money for a board game that never gets made. I mean, you know what I mean?
So do you go on to Kickstarter.com and look for all their offerings and see if there's something you're interested in?
Yeah, exactly. And it basically got started from a bunch of guys who wanted to help out friends' projects and wanted to make sure this happened. And you know the interesting thing to me? I was talking about this with a guy from Harvard Business School. And he said, you know, we think of this as so new. It's not so new. The dome in Florence, they couldn't figure out how to put the dome on the Florence Cathedral. In the 15th century, it was a very, very hard problem. And so this guy named Brunelleschi came up with the answer. And so that was this idea of sort of putting this, you know, out to the crowd. What's the best answer out there? And funding it that way. Maya Lin. How did Maya Lin get chosen to make the Vietnam Veterans Memorial?
I don't know.
They did an open call. People from around the world contributed their ideas of what that Vietnam Memorial should look like. She was an undergraduate at Yale.
Yeah, she was very controversial,
too. That was, 30 years ago?
Yes. Remember how upset people were?
It wasn't the internet, but it was really the idea of we want the best idea out there. And it does not have to come from the people who are established in the field. We want it to come from the person who's really the best. And sometimes that person can be, like Maya Lin, somebody who's very, very unexpected. I mean, like I said, an undergraduate had had really, you know, was not in an architecture firm, that kind of thing.
877-301-8970 is the number. Emily, want to take some calls?
Yeah, let's take some calls. We've got Robert, who's also on the Bourne Bridge. We get another traffic update.
How's the traffic, Robert?
Hi. It's not looking very good. The bridge is actually down to one lane getting onto the Cape.
Oh, God. Okay.
And I was sitting in traffic when your show started.
Uh-oh. That was 2 hours ago.
I'm sorry, Robert. You're having a tough day, but you can listen to us. So there you go.
Yeah. Oh, you've been keeping me very entertained.
Good.
All right. What's your issue with Kickstarter?
No issue. I think it's great. I actually have a project that's going to go live in a couple days.
Really?
What is it?
It's an open source hi-fi stereo system. And the cool thing about it has like a touch screen, LCD for all the controls. You can control it with your smartphone, like a remote. You can stream music to it. But what I think is really neat about Kickstarter is for small technology projects, it's a great way to get, you know, literally a kickstart. Because if you're going to make something technology-wise, it's not very cost-efficient to sell like one or two radios. But if you can raise enough money to sell, say, 100 all at once, you can start buying your components from manufacturers and get like the bulk discount. And then that way I can sell the systems to whoever wants to buy it at basically the cost of the parts if they were to source that themselves. And then I make money because I get to take advantage of the discounts because I bought, you know, 100 LCD screens
from whatever
manufacturer.
That's a great call. Thank you very much. And I really hope the traffic improves for you on your ride.
Well, I think Robert makes a great point. Now, I will say that there's a caveat here, which is that sometimes making something is so much harder than coming up with the idea. You've got a brilliant idea. And I've met people whose projects were so incredibly successful. I remember interviewing somebody. They had won $35,000. They made $500,000. That was how many people wanted their project. And they realize that to scale it up, right? To make thousands. Yeah. All of a sudden, it was this little thing called the Twine. And it was, about the size of a deck of playing cards. And it was basically this sensor that remotely can sense moisture. So you know how like a lot of people in Somerville live in those triple deckers and stuff, right? So you can be sitting on the top floor. You can put that in your basement, let's say, and it can sense moisture. So it can sense whether your basement's about to flood or just little trickle instead of like coming down 2 days later and there's 5 feet of water in your basement. It could also sense motion. This was really interesting. So you could put it on top of your washing machine and it would text you on your third floor and say, you know, your wash is done. Stopped moving.
My hot water heater broke just last week. I couldn't use one of those things.
So, but there is this trouble of, you know, when something's really popular and things on Kickstarter now, there have been projects that have gotten $10 million.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, it's great. You're drowning in money, but you also got 10,000 orders for something, you know, and
manufacturing.
Exactly.
Like
you're not GE. You're not used to, you know, finding somebody in China who's going to crank these things out for you. And how do you market it? And how do you ship it? And that's tough. But it's fascinating. We have a conversation about it this weekend, and actually Edgar's going to be on too. And I talked to this guy from the Wharton School.
Saturday at 10?
Okay. It was hilarious. One of the projects that got approved was about bronies. Do you know what this is?
No.
It's male adult fans of My Little Pony. Bronies. Yes,
male,
I know. It's going to take a second
fans.
To digest.
My Little Pony.
I didn't know My Little Pony was still around.
Yeah, remember that? Oh, my God. I didn't either. That was for way, way back when. Go ahead. We got some more calls.
Yeah, we got some calls. Let's say Jeff from Roslindale.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
So we, our family uses Kickstarter a lot. We've probably funded about better than a half dozen projects so far.
Like and what?
So let's see. A couple publishing Kickstarters for graphic novels that my daughter and I both enjoy that were started online, but also a documentary, and also a local company, some MIT folks, who make a solar cooker device that they started as a project to bring fuel-efficient cooking to folks out in the steppes of Asia and other places where where fuel is difficult to come by.
Jeff, do you cook with this solar cooker?
Well, as a matter of fact, what we did is a bunch of us got together, and because it's a fairly expensive device, yes, you do cook with it, that we weren't going to purchase on our own, but a bunch of us got together and said, hey, if we all contribute a certain amount, can we get the benefit and gift it to another group? And that's what we did.
All right, so what do you get out of this other than satisfaction?
Well, I get a little gimme. I contributed to that project about $25, and what I'm going to get is a little thumb drive with a bunch of behind-the-scenes stuff on how they developed and put it together. And I'm a nerd, so that appeals to me. If I was willing to kick in, like, say, $250, I would have actually gotten one of the devices once they went into production.
I see.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is neat.
I mean, people like being part of things. And I have to say,
this has gone so mainstream.
Now, more than 10%, I believe, of films at Sundance and Tribeca and South by Southwest were funded by Kickstarter. So this is like not little tiny fringe stuff. This is, you mean, when 10% of the films at Sundance came from Kickstarter projects, we're really talking about something that is changing an industry.
You know, when I look at this guy like Spike Lee, he doesn't need Kickstarter.
Yeah,
that's crazy. And it's like people, they're a sucker. You're going to go out sit in a basketball game with Spike Lee? You're going to give him $10,000?
He doesn't need it. Yeah, but I mean, obviously, if you're going to give Spike Lee $10,000 to a basketball game, it's a disposable $10,000. I mean, nobody's doing that with their last $10,000,
right.
I hope.
Jeff Bezos can do that, I guess. Jimmy in Manchester. What do you think, Jimmy?
Hey, great conversation. I really enjoyed tuning in today. So my question is, you know, I have a friend who raised about $7,000 to Kickstarter for a book called People Work. And, you know, and most of the money actually came from really outside of Kickstarter. People just kind of donated to the project that was within his personal network. But my concern with companies like Kickstarter that are crowdfunding, I think first it's really exciting because, you know, you can bring a product to market if you're a small company without getting, you know, going through the normal process of raising capital, which is very difficult. But the question I have for you, Kara, is do you think there's a period of time where this thing evolves? Because people who actually get a Kickstarter funding, they don't launch on time, they don't ship on time, they never bring their product to market, or they don't ask for enough money, and they don't have the ability to actually develop whatever they're trying to develop. And people get frustrated by that, right? And I know there's a lot of stories that I've read online about people basically their projects getting delayed, never actually, you know, getting out there. So do you see this evolving in some way where there's some accountability behind actually launching your product?
I mean, it's a great question. So there's a few things here. One is that it's absolutely true that there's sort of no real process of knowing when you're going to get your stuff. And as I was saying, you know, people get a ton of money. They get deluged by money, and they're not in the manufacturing business. All of a sudden, they've got this money. They've got this idea, and they got to go out there and make it happen. And it is, they think they can do it in 3 months, and they are wrong. They cannot do it in 3 months. It is a lot harder than they thought. I will say, one of the people I talked to on the show this weekend is Ethan Mollick, like I said, from the Wharton School. And he's looked at, I think, 48,000 of these projects. And he said it is almost unheard of for somebody to, let's say, take the money and run. Even though they could totally do it, people don't tend to do it. First of all, the regular general public tends to give to you if you have this very sort of good campaign that looks really legitimate. And so it's vetted that way. So I'd say, yes, things are getting better and better in terms of people vetting them, but you're absolutely right. These are not professionals and it may take them longer to get their product to you than it's going to take Procter & Gamble to get anything to you.
Okay, you can hear more about all this. This is Saturday morning at 10, correct? On Kara Miller, because Kara Miller is the host of Innovation Hub. You can also catch it tonight at 9. What's tonight at 9, please?
We are talking about Jeremy Rifkin and sort of the new energy revolution. And I should also say, on Saturday, we're also going to have a really interesting conversation about the maverick inventor Nikola Tesla, the arch enemy of Thomas Edison.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kara Miller. Thank you very much, Emily Rooney.
Thank you
guys for listening to us on Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we are playing a repeat of some of the better conversations we've had over the year about the Boston Symphony Orchestra, the great Gatsby movie, and the great animal rights pioneer, Temple Grandin. Emily Rooney's been filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. Our show is a production of WGBH.